Well, any questions about anything from last time? Or about anything? So last time I proved big theorem that if F is Lipschitz smooth, then the Fourier series converges to F. So last time I proved the big theorem. I actually proved it for C1, but then when I looked at my proof, I realized that all I needed was a Lipschitz estimate, so I could so I would get the equivalent of L'Hopital's rule. L'Hopital's rule allowed me to get all that those functions were nice and bounded and didn't cause integrals to behave badly. And so the fact from last time was that if F is 2 pi periodic and Lipschitz, I spelled Lipschitz wrong last time, it's SCH. Smooth. And what I really, the one I did carefully was C1 smooth case. Then, the Fourier series for F converges to F at each X. And I did it by looking carefully at the Dirichlet kernel and analyzing it carefully. It's a fantastic result. And now I want to show you that if F is C2 smooth, then not only do I get great this convergence at each X, I get uniform convergence, and not only that, but absolute convergence. So this time, if F is C2, let's see, F is 2 pi periodic and C2 smooth, meaning two continuous differentiables, two continuous derivatives, then Sn converges to F uniformly and not only that, absolutely. And actually, this isn't going to involve much in the way of work. Let me mention Stein's notation. I haven't really needed it until today. So Stein's notation is, he writes F hat of n for the nth Fourier coefficient. So I've been calling that C sub n, and that's 1 over 2 pi integral from minus pi to pi of F of x e to the minus I n x dx. That's a standard notation in Fourier analysis. And this hat is how Fourier denoted his Fourier transforms and that kind of thing. So it gets used a lot in Fourier analysis. Later on we'll study Fourier transform, which is an integral operator. And we'll use the hat for that, too. This is called the discrete Fourier transform because these n are discrete numbers in some circles. Another thing Stein likes to do is, not today we know that F is equal to its Fourier series expansion, but until you know that fact, Stein likes to write F corresponds to its Fourier series. Let's see, instead of the CNs there, I'll put the Stein's thing. And so that means that F corresponds to this Fourier series. And in good cases, this squiggly line is going to be an equality. For example, if F is C1, then that's an equality. And now I want to play around a minute just to get some ideas. So let's daydream a little bit. Let's say I had F. I'll go back to using my own notation. Is a Fourier series of Cn e to the inx. If this thing converges really fast and really well, then I ought to be able to differentiate it term by term. So I'm just daydreaming here. F prime, so maybe I'll put it equal question mark here. If I differentiate that term by term, then I would get, let's see, when I differentiate e to the inx, I get incn e to the inx. By the way, you could check that by writing this as cosine nx plus I sine x, nx, and differentiating with respect to n, and you could show, aha, this is a true identity. And once you've shown it's a true identity, you never have to do stuff like that again. You can differentiate complex exponential just like the real exponential. And why not do it again? So I could differentiate again, and maybe when I do it again, an in would come out twice. And let's see, so I'd get an in squared cn e to the inx. And I squared is equal to minus 1, so this would just be equal to minus n squared. And so here's the question that occurs to us by playing that game. Let's see, these coefficients here ought to be the Fourier coefficients for the derivative. So in Stein's notation, that would be the nth Fourier coefficient for the derivative, and the question is that equal to in times the nth Fourier coefficient for f. And then the second one would be if I take two derivatives and look at the nth Fourier coefficient for that, is that equal to minus n squared times the nth Fourier coefficient for f? And the answer is going to be yes. And the way to see it is just to write out the formula for these things and do integration by parts. It's really all there is to it. So here's why. Let's see, if I take the derivative and look at the nth Fourier coefficient, that would be 1 over 2 pi, integral from minus pi to pi, f prime of x, e to the inx dx. And I want to show you what, if Eli Stein were in the room, what he would do. He would say, aha, I learned integration by parts. For real functions, it works fine. For complex functions, too. And I could check that. So let's see, if I was going to do integration by parts, f prime dx would be my dv, and e to the inx would be my du. So here's what you should do. Let's write this as the integral from minus pi to pi. F prime of x dx is going to be my dv. And then e to the inx is going to be my u, d. This is going to be my u. And so let's see, if u is that, then du is going to be in e to the inx. Oops, I messed something up. This is e to the minus inx. And so du is minus that. And if dv is f prime of x dx, then v is f of x. And so now going back to integration by parts, remember integration by parts, this would be 1 over 2 pi u times v minus, let's see, evaluated between minus pi and pi minus the integral of v du from minus pi to pi.
Du should be minus I n e minus I n.
Yeah, I keep missing my, that's a minus. Thank you. Okay, and the great thing is, because f is 2 pi periodic and e to the I n x is 2 pi periodic, these are going to, this is going to be 0. So this one is 0 because everything in sight is 2 pi periodic. Because u and v are 2 pi periodic. That's nice. And so this integral boils down to 1 over 2 pi integral from, let's see, a minus that, integral from minus pi to pi, let's see, v du. V is f of x, and my du is minus I n x is minus I n e to the minus I n x dx. And look at, I get a minus to minus, and so sure enough the I n pulls out front of the integral and I get what I want to get. So I'm going to get the I n pulls out and I'm left with the Fourier coefficient for f, the nth one. And that is big check. That works great. And after you work with complex functions like this, it feels very natural. It felt natural for me. I wasn't the least bit squeamish about doing that. But if you are squeamish, you could do this. Or let's see, I had that integral up there, f prime Fourier coefficient, the nth Fourier coefficient for f prime. I would write like this, 1 over 2 pi integral from minus pi to pi, f prime of x dx, and where the e to the inx goes, let's see, this would be e to the minus inx. That would be cosine nx minus I sine nx. And then I could pull this apart into real and imaginary parts, and these would be these integrals. You do know how to do integration by parts in Prussian calculus. And you do exactly what I did up there and put it all together and you'd see, aha, I proved this from first principles. And that would show that what I was doing actually worked. And do real integrals. Get the same thing. And of course I can do it again. I won't do it again, but then you get the formula for the next one. Similarly, we can show that the Fourier coefficients for the second derivative are minus n squared times the Fourier coefficient for f. But this is a fantastic thing. This means that if f is twice differentiable, then look at this thing would be a nice bounded thing. So if f is C2 smooth, so here's the aha moment when we're going to get something. This thing is bounded, right? The f double prime n Fourier coefficient is equal to 1 over 2 pi integral from minus pi to pi. If it's C2 smooth, this thing is nice and bounded, and this thing has unit modulus, e to the minus inx dx. So if I take the modulus of that thing, what do I get? So if I take the modulus, that would be less than or equal to 1 over 2 pi times the integral from minus pi to pi of the absolute value of f double prime times the absolute value of this. I mean, that's cosine and sine. And cosine squared plus sine squared is equal to 1. So let's say this is less than or equal to m since it's bounded. If it's C2 smooth, that's a continuous function on the compact interval from minus pi to pi, the closed interval. It would assume a max. And so that's bounded by something. Say it's bounded by m, and this modulus is equal to 1. And so that what we find, so this is going to be less than or equal to, well, that's an interval of length 2 pi, so this would be less than or equal to 1 over 2 pi times m times 1, and the length of that integral is 2 pi. So this is less than or equal to m. If f is C2 smooth. And now I can use that top thing there to see that the Fourier coefficients of f are bounded by 1 over something over n squared. So the aha is we get this big consequence. If f is C2 smooth, then the Fourier coefficients, f hat of n, are less than or equal to m over n squared. And remember the integral test? The sum of 1 over n squared is less than infinity. So remember from back in your freshman calculus days, the integral test shows that the sum of 1 over n squared as n goes from 1 to infinity is finite. And so that one of the exercises you did for last week was the Weierstrass M test, that if you've got a series of functions that are bounded by a sequence that converges, then the thing converges uniformly. So we can compare, so a consequence of this theorem, to compare the tail end of the Fourier series to the sum of 1 over n squared, it'd be m times that, to see that that the Fourier series converges uniformly and absolutely to f. Okay, so let's see. I guess to be precise, what am I doing? I'm doing, I've got a cn e to the inx. And that would be equal to cn e to the inx. And e to the inx has modulus 1. And this one is less than or equal to m over n squared. And so I can compare this complex thing to the tail end of a convergence real series. And that was the exercise you did that was the comparison test, sometimes called the Weierstrass M test. Okay, but we know it goes to F pointwise. That's what I showed last time. And so now the rest of it, the uniform and the absolute, comes from today. That's good, yeah.
I'm sorry, I might have missed something, but where did you get the M? I'm not sure.
Oh, M was the bound for F double prime. This is where I introduced it. Since F is C too smooth, that means F double prime is continuous. And it's a continuous function on a closed interval, so it has max. I'm calling that max M, so I kind of verbally defined it right there. Other questions? Okay, so now if Bernoulli could have shown this to his dad, he would have shown that his series converges and been able to make more sense of what he was doing. It took a long time for these things to be developed. And now I want to do this thing called Thayer's theorem. It was because the Dirichlet kernel had certain delicate things about it that made it harder to manipulate. And there's this famous theorem of Thayer. Let's see, I guess before I talk about Thayer, I should talk about something called Chesaro sums. Chesaro means. We want to see that the Fourier series converges to F, but here's something else you can look at. These are called Chesaro means. You take the zeroth order term in the Fourier series, then the first order term in the Fourier series, plus blah blah blah, out to the nth order Fourier series. Let's say I better go to n minus 1. And divide by n. So I'm averaging all the Fourier series out to order n. It turns out that converges nicer than the Fourier series itself. So let's see, this would just be a naught. This would be the terms up to order 1. And these would be the adding up the terms up to order n minus 1. There's n of those things, and I average them. And the mind-blowing thing is the Chesaro means converge to F very nicely and very easy to show. So this is Thayer's theorem. Let's call this sigma n. Thayer's theorem is that if F is continuous, then the Chesaro means of the Fourier series converge uniformly to F. So if F is 2 pi periodic and continuous, only merely continuous. Some books call those the Thayer means, but they're also called Chesaro means. Then those things converge to F uniformly. And the great thing is the proof is kind of nice and easy. And we've done all the work already. We messed around and figured out what the Dirichlet kernels are. So when you write those things out as integrals, you get something called the Thayer kernel. So remember, Sn of x was equal to the integral from minus pi to pi of the Dirichlet kernel. And therefore, the Thayer kernel is going to be my sigma n of x is going to be, let's see, I'm going to integrate from minus pi to pi. And when I add those up and average, I would get D0 of T, these are Dirichlet kernels, plus out to the Dirichlet N minus 1 kernel. I average those divided by N and get F of X minus T dt. And this thing here is called the Fayer kernel. And it turns out to be remarkably clean and nice. F N of T. And I told you the Dirichlet kernel was a good kernel. The Fayer kernel is a very good kernel. So it's a very good kernel. Let me list the properties. Let's see. I don't think I'll do it. I mean, it's going to be a homework exercise to mess around and add up the... I had the Dirichlet kernels written in terms of that omega. And then you add those up, and you'll have geometric series which sum, but they sum to something even nicer than the Dirichlet kernel. They sum to N over 2 pi. No, I'm sorry, the N's in the denominator. 1 over 2 pi N sine squared NX over 2. And on the bottom is sine squared x over 2. Notice the squares. This thing is a positive kernel. That's nice. So the properties that are going to make it all work one, it's positive. And even though, let's see, at zero, I can use L'Hopital's rule to figure out what its value is. It's gonna be gigantic at zero. So let's see, L'Hopital's would show me that Fn at zero would be 1 over 2 pi n. And let's see, this would be sine over sine squared. And I'd use L'Hopital's rule to get sine over sine. And that would be n over 2 cosine divided by 1 over 2 squared. And so when you mess around with that, you get n over 2 pi. A great big number. So it's a kernel that's concentrated at the origin. It's just gigantic at the origin. Okay. Another property that's critical is that the integral of this thing is 1. And that's really easy because remember this is an average of Dirichlet kernels. And the integral of the Dirichlet kernels were all 1. And I have n of them there. I integrate them to be 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 n times, and then I divide by n. So this one's a brainer. It follows from the Dirichlet kernel property. So this one follows from the formula. This one's L'Hopital's rule. This one is because the same thing holds for the Dirichlet kernel. So that one's true. And now the thing that we didn't have about the Dirichlet kernel is this next one. Maybe I should graph that. Yeah, okay. Let's let I delta be equal to the interval from minus pi to minus delta, and then the interval from plus delta to plus pi. So I'm punching out a little interval from minus delta to delta out in the middle. Well, I claim that the Fayer kernel goes to zero on this I delta, uniformly. fn of x goes to 0 uniformly on I delta. And it's just, look at the formula. So here's y. Fn of x, it's this big fat 1 over n. All right, this thing is blowing up near the origin because of the L'Hopital's rule. But away from the origin, this thing, even though it's blowing up at the origin, from delta out, this would be bounded. And so the 1 over n is the thing that kills it, that makes it go to 0 uniformly. So we see from this that this is bounded. On I delta. And this thing is the killer. So I get something bounded divided by n. So that's an easy thing. Question?
Is it true in general that like if you have a good kernel and then you like do the same procedure here, like on the like average, like take like add them up and then divide by n, like take your average, like you get another good kernel? You know what I mean?
Oh, if the Dirichlet kernel was good in this sense, this would be...
No, so like the Dirichlet kernel was good, and then we averaged it, and then we got this new kernel that was also good.
But this one, I claim, is even better because of this property. Remember, the Dirichlet kernel had...
I'm saying that in general, if you take, like, so if you replace the Dirichlet kernel by, like, any other good kernel, and then you just average them, like, you always get a good kernel again.
Right, but the Dirichlet kernel isn't as good as this kernel. So, like, it's because it's negative.
Isn't there, like, a definition of good kernel, like, that they give in the book?
Stein has his own definition, right?
Like those properties.
Very, very similar, right?
Yeah.
But what this, I'm trying to emphasize here is that the Thayer kernel has a property I didn't know for the Dirichlet kernel.
But that's true for the Dirichlet kernel.
It is true. The absolute value, the being positive in this being true. The integral, so this shows that the integral of Thayer kernel is gets small on I delta. That's going to be critical.
Yeah.
That's not true for the Dirichlet one. The Dirichlet had the bad property. In fact,
the Dirichlet,
why was the Dirichlet kernel bad?
It's not a good kernel.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's pretty good. Bad thing about the Dirichlet kernel.
It's not a good kernel currently.
Was that the integral from minus pi to pi of the absolute value of dn, dx, it looks like it blows up like log n. So it goes to infinity. And that's not going to happen with the Thayer kernel, because the Thayer kernel is positive. This makes that integral for the Thayer kernel go to 0. So, but, because of this fact, okay, so I want to demonstrate the thing now, because it's remarkably easy. Do I have time? I guess I do have time. Okay. Okay, now the proof of Thayer's theorem. It's just a matter of looking at this thing and using those properties. All right, so I do what I did the last time. So I'd have my Thayer sums minus f of x, and I would write So remember this one would be an integral. I think I'll skip all the steps. When I write it out exactly like I did before, I'll get the Thayer kernel times f of x plus t minus f of x dt.
So remember what I did. I this thing was what I would get for these sums. And this one I got because the integral of the Fayer kernel is 1. And so this would be f of x times the integral of the Fayer kernel. I can pull the f of x outside the integral. And so that's f of x times 1. And that's what allowed me to stick this all under one integral. I did that last time. So basically, this is adding up the Dirichlet ones and averaging, and it spits this out. And now this here's the big idea. Outside the delta thing, the Fayer kernel is going to 0. But inside the delta thing, this is the thing that's getting small. So I'm going to split this integral into 2 pieces.
And so let's see, this would be an integral over the I delta part. That's where I cut out the middle part. Let's call this part I1. And then the other part would be the part over the minus delta to delta part. And on this part, let's think. DT. Let's call this part I2.
On this integral,
this is going to be small, because that's property 4.
And because f is continuous, this part's going to be bounded. So I've got small bounded times a bounded. That can make that integral small.
And near, on this interval, because f is continuous, this is going to be small.
But the Fayer kernel blows up. But its integral is 1, and it's positive. So I'm going to be able to take the absolute value underneath this thing and get it and estimate this by the integral of the Fayer kernel times something small. And that's going to go to 0. So these are both going to go to 0 in a nice uniform way.
So to be particular about this now, let's let epsilon be bigger than 0. Let's see, f is continuous on a closed interval, so f assumes its max. Its max m.
And f, since f is continuous on a closed interval, it's uniformly continuous.
And f is uniformly. That's a fact you learned in Math 341, that continuous function on a closed interval is uniformly continuous. And now here's where the delta comes from. So there exists a delta such that f of x plus t minus f of x is less than, I want it to be less than epsilon over 2 if mod t is less than, absolute t is less than delta.
Okay, that's going to make this part small. So now I'm going to estimate I2.
Okay, so now I2, I guess I should keep it in sight. There it is. Now, I2 is going to be absolute value of that integral. And that's going to be less than or equal to the integral of the absolute value. Absolute value of the Fayer kernel is itself, because it's positive. And then I'll get the absolute value of x plus t minus t, f of x, dt. So I'm using in a critical moment here, the Fayer kernel is positive.
That was
I didn't have that for the Dirichlet kernel, so I couldn't have done this back for the Dirichlet kernel. This is Fayer only. And this thing is less than or equal to epsilon over 2. Okay, so that's feeling good. I've got that this is now less than or equal to epsilon over 2 times the integral of the Fayer kernel from delta to delta. But the Fayer kernel is positive, is no more, is not, and so this integral would be even less than the integral from minus pi to pi. So this is less, in fact it's strictly less, but let's say less than or equal to epsilon over 2, a bigger integral from minus pi to pi. And that's equal to 1. And so I2 is less than or equal to epsilon over 2. And so now all I have to do is get is the other integral bounded, and that's the one that turns out to be a snap. So next, I'm going to mess around with I1. Let's see, what was that? That would be the absolute value of the integral over the I delta. That's the punched out interval of fn of t times f of x plus t minus f of x dt. And let's see, that'll be less than or equal to integral over I delta. And I couldn't do this before because the Dirichlet kernel wasn't positive. But it is, the Fayer kernel is positive. So I'm using the fact that this is greater than or equal to 0. And then this thing is going to be less than or equal to absolute f plus absolute f of x dt. And remember, I showed you that continuity of f implies that f is bounded. So this is less than or equal to 2m. And so now, finally, this is going to be less than or equal to the max of fn on the I delta times 2m times the length of this interval. Well, the length of that interval is 2 pi minus 2 delta. And this goes to 0. Delta's fixed. So I fixed delta and I made that second integral less than epsilon over 2. This is fixed, and by letting n go to infinity now, I can make this part small enough to make this less than epsilon over 2. So this goes to 0 as n goes to infinity. So I can make it less than epsilon over 2. That's neat. And that's a very classic argument in analysis. If you ever study the Poisson kernel, these exact properties are properties of the Poisson kernel. And you use those properties to do exactly the same thing. You split the integral into two pieces. One where the function is small by continuity, and the other where the kernel is small. You'll see it coming up again and again in more advanced math classes. So you remember the Weierstrass theorem about polynomials being dense? What we've shown here is that trigonometric polynomials are dense. So we have a theorem here that pops right out. So remember the Weierstrass theorem. Polynomials are dense on continuous functions. on a closed interval. That's a Math 341 kind of thing. Did you prove it in Math 341? New? 440 maybe? It's a famous thing. So you get a it means you get a continuous function. So f is continuous. There exists a polynomial. So given an epsilon bigger than zero, there exists a polynomial such that f minus p is less than epsilon on that closed interval. That's what I mean by dense. Well, I've shown you by Fayer's theorem that trigonometric polynomials are dense in the realm of periodic functions. So today, we call this Fayer's theorem. Trigonometric polynomials those are what you get from Fourier series. Those are the best trigonometric polynomials. Are dense among 2π periodic continuous functions. And that's going to have some pretty interesting consequences. For example, it's going to give us a two-line proof that of that Parseval's identity. We had a Bessel's inequality, but because of Fayer's theorem, Bessel's inequality is going to become an equality, and that's the Parseval identity. So next time I'll show you in two lines consequence Bessel's inequality becomes an equality. Becomes the Parseval identity. In other words, it's an equality instead of inequality for Fourier series. And I'll show you that next time. It's a very simple two-line thing. Surprisingly simple. And it falls right out from Fayer's. Any last-minute questions about anything? Well, this stuff has been the most technical thing we've done, and certainly the most mathematical last couple days. I think I'm going to cool it a little bit on Friday and go back to showing you where Fourier series come up in practice. I want to do the heat equation. I want to do the hot wire problem. And it's very similar to the vibrating string problem, and it shows you where Fourier series come up. So if you read chapter one, you'll be ready for that. So you should be reading chapter one is in the past now. I'm going to finish off a couple things in chapter one, but you should be reading chapter two now. Let's see, did Kevin Colbert come in? Colbert? Is it Colbert or Colbert?
Bear.
What?
Colbert.
Bear. Okay, that's what I said.
There's a question in the complex homework that I'm wondering about. It's the one about sine. And it starts off by saying, like, we know that e to the x plus I y equal e to the x times e to the I y. Just find a similar formula for sine.
Oh, you're talking about that pi phase.
Yeah.
So, you know, that formula is going to involve e to the x cosine and sine. And so when you do it for sine, it's going to involve, you're going to want a u of x, y, that's the real part,
and the v of x, y, that's the imaginary part, and they're going to involve basic functions.
Okay.
It's going to involve hyperbolic
functions.
You could use, I showed you today, the sum of two angles for all the holes.
I mean, it's like the two lines wave.